Welcome to Talk Zone Radio. This is your host, Clint Studer. Leading into the show is a song called I Can Start a Fire by Alex Call and Lisa Carey. Alex Call and Lisa Carey, longtime musicians that currently reside in Nashville, have put together a album called Passion and Purpose, which is particularly written for healthcare, but certainly all people can enjoy their music, but they have a number of songs that are connected to the healthcare worker. From I Can Start a Fire, about making a difference, to The Calling, about the calling we have in healthcare. Lisa's a breast cancer survivor, and she wrote a song called Time to Live about what it feels like when you're diagnosed with cancer. For more information on their music, you can go to www.studergroup.com. For Passion and Purpose, you can go to Facebook for Passion and Purpose, and they will get you right to a little bit more about their music. You can even see them in concert. It's my great pleasure to welcome Bob Murphy. Bob Murphy and I have gone way back to June 9th of 1996 when I first met Bob when I became president of Baptist Hospital. And he was going to law school, had been had a master's in healthcare public administration, also a RN, worked in the emergency room and paramedics. And Bob was currently in going to law school and working the summer as a shift supervisor, and of course we were lucky enough to keep Bob after he got his law degree, and he proceeded and ended up being president of Baptist Hospital himself, and about 3 years ago joined Studer Group as a national speaker, and we're so glad to have him with Studer Group, and I want Bob today to talk a little bit about what he finds when he goes out, and I'm going to ask him a number of specific questions about service, quality, finance, people and growth, and a little bit about his recent trip to Australia and what he learned about, you know, healthcare that has a different payer system, so on. Bob, welcome to Talk Zone.
Oh, Quinn, thanks for having me on.
Well, first of all, I have to do a little bit rounding. How's Laura, your wife?
She's wonderful. She's getting the house decorated, of course, and doing a wonderful job.
And how's Caitlin? What is she running these days?
I think she's running her kindergarten class and the special reading group she developed.
Good, because she's been ready for kindergarten since she's been about two, hasn't she?
She has. In fact, during the Thanksgiving break, she was disappointed that school had to be closed so many days. She wanted us to bring her back early.
And how's Bobby? I know you're going over to the school you said today for something with Bobby.
Yeah, we're going to build part two of his gingerbread house today at the school with his class. It's nice to be able to do that with him, and I know it makes him feel good to have his parents there visiting in the classroom.
I was in Asheville, North Carolina this last week, and they have a national gingerbread, and it was hundreds of gingerbread homes, and they were just absolutely incredible. And the first thing that hit me is I could never do one because I wouldn't have the patience.
Right. Well, we found some of the kids last week when we put the structure together, didn't have the patience. It actually reminded me of my work that I do with leader teams. A funny story that, you know, they wanted to rush and put the roof on before the sides were holding themselves together. And, of course, the roofs collapsed, and we had to go back and do a bunch of rework and get extra supplies, and the kids were upset. Ultimately, they all looked good, but, boy, it took us a lot of extra work doing that. It's amazing that you could learn that lesson in the fifth grade and have to relearn it again when you become an adult.
You know, usually I start the show by getting a lot into the person's background, and we'll do that later, but let's get right into that topic because you're out there in healthcare all the time. You're working with executive teams. I find the same thing, that we're sometimes so in a hurry to implement a number of tactics that we don't really maximize one tactic before we go to the second tactic, and then we lose the first tactic. Tell us about some of your, if you've been on the road for 3 years, what are some of your key learnings as you've traveled the country speaking to organizations? Like you're going to, I know, be in Tampa Bay, you're going to be going into San Antonio this week, and you're on the road each week. What are, for the listeners, what are some of your key learnings and key tips?
It's funny that you asked the question that way. I've seen this, I've been developing in my head this sort of list of what I've been calling universal truths. And there are some universal, believe it or not, universal solutions. But the universal truths, things that I've seen now in hospitals all over the United States, in Canada, in Australia, the three countries that I've been in, is number one, inconsistency. And I know that's the whole premise of your book, Straight A Leadership, is how we align and act and hold people accountable to decrease inconsistency or build consistency from leaders. That's number one. Number two, an almost fear-like problem with dealing with low performers. I can't describe. It's almost an emotional aversion to wanting to deal with low performers. We all know who they are. We could make a list right now of who they are in just about every organization. But then when it comes time to act and do something about it, there's 10 excuses. The union, the human resources department, my training, will be short-staffed, on and on and on. That's number two. And number three is sequencing, trying to do too many things at once and maybe not even in the right order. Those would be the three that would come to my mind.
When you go out and you see that, for example, tell me what you mean when you say inconsistency. Because, you know, I think when I look at healthcare, there's certainly certain things we're very consistent with. You know, I think we manage the parking lots well. We're very consistent. I think EDs, emergency departments, have really over the years become very consistent with, let's say, aspirin to an acute MI. We're very consistent many times with how we do the schedule, how we pay, how we do benefits, when the visiting hours are. I mean, we're so consistent that we have a rough time even not being consistent for the right reason. So when you say the word inconsistency, for our listeners, can you go a little bit into what you mean by that? Because I think my gut is everybody listening to this show is shaking their head. Yes, they see inconsistency. But can you go in a little bit more in detail on when you say inconsistency, where?
Yeah, in lots of places. Of course, you mentioned places that we are very good at. But I'm talking about basic things like how we hire people, how we communicate with our staff, how we reward and recognize each other, how we fire, all of those sort of basic leadership skills that leadership development and training will help solve. There's inconsistency from leader to leader. I hire a little differently than my colleagues do, and unless someone points out to me, unless I'm held accountable for results, hiring better, having lower turnover, then there's no incentive to change my behavior. When I think of consistency, here are the things that I know that we do really, really well. I know in human resources, if I went to go apply for a job as a nurse at a hospital, I guarantee you at every hospital that we work with and every hospital listening, that they are going to check to make sure I'm a nurse before they let me actually practice. If I was a physician, Quint, and I wanted to go practice on a medical staff, I'm pretty confident that 100% of the time they would check to make sure I was really a doctor before they let me go practice. There are very few fake doctors running around the world. But if I ask a simple question like, how good are we at getting people to wash their hands, you know, the number one way to prevent infections in our hospitals, we're not so good at that. There's a lot of reasons why we can't do that. That's what I'm talking about, inconsistency. Individual behavior, either at the staff level or at the leader level, where we allow optional behavior versus agreeing on what's mandatory behavior. You brought up a few that are mandatory. Park in a certain place, we're good at it. Wear a certain uniform, we're good at it. I think what this boils down to, when I see it from leader to leader, it's when the senior leadership team decides what's mandatory versus what's optional.
It's amazing you say that. I was talking to Janet Pilcher, and Janet Pilcher, Dr. Pilcher, is a doctor in education, and, you know, we've been working with some school districts, and this last week, the principals basically said to administration, tell us what you want us to do, tell us what the expectations are, and literally the administrative team almost are reluctant to say this is mandatory, this is required. This autonomy or this need to be autonomy, which ties into number two, if we're afraid of, if we have inconsistency, it's very hard to deal with low performers because there's inconsistency, which is accepted. So how can I get rid of this person in my department because they can get away with it here? But we're going to get into that fear problem of one of the universal truths, and I love that comment, universal solutions. But I want to talk, but continue to go on inconsistency because you mentioned training. And I find it's, you know, I talk to nurses, and I remember I was at Christian Brothers, really a fun organization, doing really good work outside St. Louis. And we talked about this whole idea of consistency. And I remember talking to a nurse manager, and I asked her how many different ways they train their nurses to start an IV. And she looked at me like, what do you mean? I said, well, there must be a lot of techniques. Which ways do you train your staff? And she basically said, I train them all the same way. And I said, well, what would happen if somebody didn't do it that way? And, you know, of course, she said, well, it wouldn't be tolerated. I said, how long would you tolerate it? She said, well, not at all, because you want to do it a certain way. Of course, all for the right reasons, Bob, the right clinical outcome. Yet I do believe when it comes to leadership, we are much more accepting of inconsistency or autonomy. And my gut is because senior leaders sort of like autonomy at their level, but that's my feeling. When you look at inconsistency like hiring, what are some of your takeaways?
What I see is usually it's lack of training. I know the places that we work with as partners, the organizations that we work with, spend a ton of time and very valuable time in doing leadership development and training, and How to Hire happens to be one of them. But I get to see all kinds of organizations, including non-partners, and there's this reluctance to spend the time necessary. I can't imagine the nurse leader you were just using in your example saying, I don't have time to go off and train my staff on how to start IVs or read EKGs or move people so that they don't get hurt when we carry them out of bed. We would never say that, but for some reason, we've decided in leadership, and I say this globally, it's a generalization, that there are some skills that are just natural, like when we promote you, you're just going to know how to hire people, or if we have a good policy or procedure, you'll follow it, without the actual investment of the time to practice. That'd be like saying that I could, when I was 17 years old, get the motor vehicle book and read it, and that should be enough to be able to go drive. No, there are many hours involved, behind the wheel, someone sitting next to me, showing me what to do, keeping me out of danger, keeping themselves out of danger in my case. You know, practice, practice, practice. And even then, we have accidents as adults and others. So it's the amount of time in training and the curriculum. I am amazed when I go to organizations and I say, what is the leadership development and training curriculum that you have available? And they'll show me wonderful courses. I just did this weekend for Subway restaurants outside of healthcare, and I asked them to give me a list of their mandatory training for leaders at their stores, because I wanted to see if there were any connections between what we do. And while the topics were a little different, like how to bake bread, you know, versus how to start an IV, most of the topics had to do with the same things we say: how to hire, how to communicate, how to get people to do what you need them to do. But here's the universal part of this truth: they're optional, not mandatory. So the stores that are doing it well, we found out through the discussion with them, are doing better with their results. Same thing in healthcare.
I was at a hospital, we know I do a lot of surveys that's in my book, Straight A Leadership, and in general, and the number one barrier to people being successful or getting their job done or having outcomes, they tell me, is time.
Right.
And then when we dig into the time, one of the biggest things, waste of times that they feel they have in healthcare, is meetings, too many meetings. All you have to do is say, do you guys feel you have too many meetings? And the heads roll and the grumbling comes. And basically then I ask, let's say, for example, Bob, when I was at president of a hospital, almost over a third of the patients have diabetes, not as maybe their primary reason they're in the hospital, but they have diabetes as a secondary, as something that a precursor for other issues that gets them in the hospital. And we would do tremendous amounts of training on dealing with patients with diabetes because we saw it so much. So you would think as a leader, if meetings are such a big issue, we would have specific ways to run a meeting. So I would ask, well, if meetings are such a problem, and I even have them calculate how many hours a week they spend in an unproductive meeting. And then I ask, do you have an agreed-upon meeting template? Do you have agreed upon that if you run a meeting, you need training and run a meeting? And they all go no. Or if they do, and I remember this so vividly in New York, they said, yeah. In fact, the chief learning officer sort of said, well, Quint, wait a minute, time out. We run a great program on how to run a meeting. And she went over her curriculum, the whole deal. And then I said, well, is it mandatory? She said, no, it's optional. And I think optional training does not get you to consistency. Optional training, in fact, almost creates more inconsistency, because now you have some people doing it one way, some people doing it the other way. So I would agree with you. We're very reluctant at times to create a mandatory type system of training. And so your belief is that skill development is actually what will create the consistency.
Absolutely. Leaders, I mean, I think of my own experience, Clint, when I was first promoted from a staff member to a manager. It was a process. Basically, they needed to replace the leader that was there. I got promoted basically with a 10-minute interview, and I had no mentoring, no training, but I made some really silly mistakes, Clint. I'll tell you, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you, but because you weren't there at the time that this happened, I didn't know what an FTE was for 8 months. I ran an emergency department with 75 FTEs, and I'd heard the phrase every month I got a responsibility report, and every month they showed it at department meeting. But I thought the E meant employee. I didn't know that it meant equivalent, and there was a mathematical equation, until a lady named Deborah Bunch, our budget director, was sitting down with me planning the next year's budget. And she could tell I didn't know what I was talking about when I was talking about the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you run a department with 75 FTEs and not even know what it is? It's because lack of consistent training for every new leader, or every leader in general. Now I look back on that and I think, well, that couldn't happen today, could it? And then I visit hospitals where it is happening. About once every fifth time I speak and tell that story, someone will come up to me and said, thank God you told me the definition. I didn't know what it meant either.
Oh, I think that's it, with bond rating, with debt financing, with cost per adjusted occupied bed, with mortality index. I think almost all our glossary of terms, we just assume that a leader might know it, and they just absolutely do not. And then, unfortunately, I don't know about you, but I was the same way, and I didn't want to raise my hand and say I don't know, because then they'll think I'm stupid. So basically, my first year in a leadership role, the only time I learned something is when I made a mistake or I didn't turn something in. And, of course, that just ties us into that whole feeling of we don't know what we're doing and we're the only one. And that's why I love bringing big groups of leaders together, because it allows them to realize that they're not alone. And in healthcare, we're very isolated in leadership, Bava. And I think you were probably running an ER at the time, right?
Yes, that's right.
And you're very isolated. I mean, you're the only manager down there. When I worked in the summers at General Motors and Ford Motor Companies, and I will tell you that our department could probably look down. I know we could look in the warehouse and see other supervisors, other foremen. Healthcare is one of those deals where when you're a leader, you're in an isolated position. So you're not doing a lot of observation. No one ever came up to me and said, we're going to give you a week to go spend time with a great leader so you can learn.
Right. No, that doesn't happen. It does happen in some special places, but that's pretty rare. And you were right. I was the only ED leader. There wasn't another one like me that I could even go have a cup of coffee with, because the closest one was my competitor. And, of course, we're not going to do that in most communities. So,
or we don't want them to know that we don't know.
No, we don't know. I didn't know what I didn't know. You're exactly right. I live my life now asking that question just about every day when I'm in front of an audience. I like to say, I don't know what I don't know. So if you think I've made a mistake, or I've done something wrong, or I've said something wrong about your organization, would you let me know? Because I want to role model that behavior for them, to ask the same question. I don't know what I don't know. Can you help me?
Bob, in closing, before we go to our break, I think that's absolutely right. I'll even say to people now, have I covered? Is there some questions I should ask that I'm not asking? Is there something I should know that I'm walking out here that I don't know? Because if I don't do that, I don't dig as deep as I need to dig. And for leaders in here, that's a great thing to do with consultants. If you're looking or negotiating with vendors and you have more than one, say, are there some questions that you were prepared for that I didn't ask? And what were those? Because that allows you to find out some things and you just get better and better. So it's time to take a short break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Bob Murphy right after this. I Welcome back to Talk Zone Radio with your host, Quint Studer, and our guest today, Bob Murphy. That was, again, I'm Alex Call and Lisa Carey, bringing us here with the song I Can Start a Fire About Making a Difference. Bob, we were talking about inconsistency, and I was talking about a tip I learned in interviewing vendors and consultants is to say to them, is there anything that I didn't cover, any questions you were prepared for that I didn't ask? And you say when you go out to organizations, you're sort of looking for the same thing. I do want to close with a couple inconsistencies that I've noticed that I think for our listeners, in particular our C-suite listeners in the executive offices, a couple of my wake-up calls, as I've learned about leaders, and we talked about leaders sometimes assuming through osmosis or something that they know or have information or skill set that they just don't have. One of the things that amazed me, and I talk about, Bob, when I talk about groups, I talk about finances. And I say, in finances as a C-suite, whenever we had a month where we made money or lost money, we reported that to the board. And if we had a operating revenue over income, you know, or over expenses, we would report. And I'm, for this conversation, to keep it simple, I'm going to say, let's say we made $100,000 that month. I would tell the board, you know, if the fiscal year starts in July, hey, in July, that according to budget, here's what we budgeted for the gain. But gee, we did $100,000 better than what was budgeted. And then the next month, I would, if we did $100,000 again, I would say, well, gee, now we did again, $100,000 better than budget, so now we're $200,000 year-to-date. And the third month, if we did it again, I would say, gee, we're $100,000 over again. We're $300,000 year-to-date. But when I told the board where we were at, in my mind, that money was gone. I had already told them that that was our profit that we had made. Now, when I talk to managers, and a manager in July, let's say, is $10,000 under in expenses, so for the month to date, of course, they're $10,000. For year to date, $10,000. Again, to keep it simple for this show, because it's from the math too. For me, the next month they do $10,000, so now they're $10,000 month to date, $20,000 year to date. Now the next month they do $10,000, so they're $10,000 that month, and they're $30,000 year to date. And what we found was, they think, hey, I've got $30,000 here that I haven't spent. They don't realize that we had told the board we made that money. We told the bond people we're beating budget. So all of a sudden, that fourth month, they're about $6,000 over in expenses, but they're $24,000 under year to date. Somebody from the C-suite's calling them in saying, what's happening? My gosh, we're $6,000 over in expenses. What are we going to do about that? And the manager's saying, well, whoa, why don't you appreciate the fact that I'm $24,000 under year-to-date?
Right.
I find that's one of the great disconnects why most organizations start losing the gains halfway through the year because the managers believe that that money is still available, yet at the board level, we've already reported to the board. Has that been your experience, Bob?
It, absolutely. That's what I see. And I almost wish because I've heard you have a similar discussion before, I almost wish we could take that year-to-date column off for the individual manager because they're managing. We're basically saying, here's the expectation. Manage to this number. And then when they do, we tell them it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Take it off. If it's a month-to-month, the way we're doing it, and then the money that's made and the profit is gone, then take it away so no one tries to spend it.
Oh, you see that in school districts. Yeah, you see it in school districts. I was working with the superintendent, and it was almost like, well, we got to spend this money here because it's in the budget. And I said, well, no you don't. And the other thing, and then I'm going to go into the other ununiversal truth after inconsistency for our listeners, is communication. I do a little thing where I say, I don't know, Bob, but when I was, you know, at the organization, we had a senior leader meeting, I think Wednesday afternoons from 1 to 5, and we would get information. There was 8 or 9 of us around a table, and then we'd be taking that back to our entities. And I say, if you're a president of a hospital or if you're a vice president meeting with your directors, the challenge is coordinating the communication. So, for example, if I have a meeting, Bob, and I'm the president on a Wednesday afternoon and we're going to make a reduction in force, and usually we organize that, actually. That's not a good example because it's so serious. But let's just say a less serious communication goes out. I find what happens is maybe the chief nurse officer happens to meet with all her nursing managers or his nursing managers on Thursday. So at 8 o'clock on Thursday, they are now hearing what happened on Wednesday. Well, maybe the chief financial officer doesn't have his meeting till the next Monday. Maybe the human resource person goes back and has a smaller department, almost tells them Wednesday afternoon. And all of a sudden, something you think is going to be well communicated is inconsistently communicated because pieces of the organization hear it too soon. And I find in almost every senior leader agenda that I look at, while the agenda is good, what they don't have on there is how is this going to be communicated? When is it going to be communicated? By who is it going to be communicated? And how is it going to be communicated? What are some of your other takeaways as you've gone around? Because I think finance and communication is one that I think is just such an easy miss that we assume something and we miss it.
Yeah, I agree. I have a particular example I use. I was visiting a non-partner organization to teach keywords at key times, and it was not something that I knew I was going to be there more than 2 hours. I had 2 hours to get all of these leaders to take something and cascade it to their staff. So as a gut check to see how well they did that, I asked, when was the last time you were asked to communicate a message to all of your staff? And it happened to be, and I knew this from my research, the day before. The CEO had just met with the entire set of leaders of the organization, about 100 people, and was talking about the effect of the external environment, Medicaid, et cetera, on their organization. So I asked the audience, what were the key points? What were the three key points of your CEO's message yesterday? And we got about 7 or 8 key points, so we was a little diluted. The message was a little diluted 1 day later. And I said, what are you supposed to do with what you learned yesterday? And that was a universal answer. The universal answer is, we're supposed to tell our staff. Yeah, lots of people said that out loud. And I said, okay, by when? And there was silence. And then I asked the two that you did not mention, Quint, that we find in our work with verification is, how will your boss know you did it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we know who and what if we're doing this well, but how do we know you ever did it? And for some things that are really important, I remember you implemented this when we did employee attitude survey rollouts. How do we know you did it well? With some things, you should actually ask the ultimate end user are the questions. Did your boss explain this in a way that you could understand it? Were they defensive in explaining the results? Do you believe action will be taken? I would add those two to your checklist of what are the key points, who should you tell and by when, how will we know you did it, and then how will we know you did it well if it's a really important communication.
That's great. One of my examples is Dr. Duncan Finley. He took over as president of a hospital. I remember him being amazed. He had me come in to speak to all the employees, and he had just had a meeting probably a couple weeks earlier and had told all the managers that patient satisfaction was important to him, that he wanted to see it improved, that he wanted everyone to focus in on it. And he really told me that he really told the leaders all his expectations. So when he met with all the employees, he basically started asking them about, have they heard that, you know, this is important to him? And he looked around, and I bet you 20% of the audience said, yeah, they understood, and 80% looked at him like, huh? And he looked at me at break, and he said, I told the leaders, well, what happened? And, of course, him being a physician, I said, welcome to administration, Dr. Finley. Because as a pulmonologist, when he used to ask the nurse to do something, it was done. When he'd ask the respiratory therapist to do something, it was done. And all of a sudden, as a leader, he just assumed when he got up and told the leaders to do something, it would be done. So I think that verification of going right to the employees at times and asking for feedback is absolutely crucial, Bob. And that's a great point. I had forgotten about that validation of, did you close the loop? Did the message really get delivered? Because sometimes we celebrate the beginning of the process, not the conclusion of the outcome.
Right. And one simple way of doing that, if you don't want to do it in a formal survey like you would do in the rollout of employee attitude action results, would be the use of senior leader rounding. If when you're out in the units, ask the people at the bedside, ask the people at the bench in the lab, did the message get delivered? In fact, not did it, but what was the message?
Right. Like, if, you know, exactly like the external environment. You know, I think employees were under such a delusion that because uninsured will be covered, that'll really be great because now all this bad debt will go away, and they might not realize that really there's going to be no more money, so it's going to be taken out of one pot to another pot. So hospitals might even have it worse, not better.
Right.
And they might even lose their tax-exempt status. And I think to most employees, if it's not well explained, they can miss that. And in my book, Straight-A Leadership, we go into great detail just showing documented research that shows that C-suite people think that the rest of the workforce is more knowledgeable about healthcare and healthcare external environment than they really are. Bob, let's go to your second universal truth. Almost, you said, a fear-like problem in dealing with low performers. Yes. Can you go over that with me as you go around the country?
Sure. And, in fact, I was hoping when I went to Australia and visited with hospital there, I was hoping it would be different so I could come back and bring some answer and say, look, it's different there. And I was really actually very pleased with the work that Studer Group's doing there. However, the issue... One of the issues they're dealing with is low performers and our reluctance to deal with them. And I use the word fear on purpose because it's almost visceral. This, I know who they are, but I don't want to deal with them. Now, there are exceptions to that, of course. I meet leaders all over the country who will come up to me after teaching our high, middle, low work that we do, and they'll come up to me and say, I have no problem with that. I fired two people last month. I know that when they're a low performer, they have a choice. But generally speaking, and I think it really ties back to our previous conversation in the last segment and this one, it's all about training. If I'm not trained how to do this, and then you say, go do it, well, that's scary. Ending someone's career, sending someone home, telling them really bad news is sometimes very hard to do for people. And without training and practice, I think training is half of the equation, or maybe even less than half the equation. I think role-playing and practice is probably weighted, should be weighted even more heavily. I see that everywhere I go. Even in places where we work sometimes, even though they have good training and good practice, there's still this reluctance to do it. And here's how I know. Everywhere I go, I ask this question. How many of you have someone working for you right now, or if it's a small place, I say someone that you know in the organization that if they quit tomorrow, you would not rehire them? And I have never seen less than half the hands go up in the room. And usually it's closer to three-quarters of the hands. So I know that this is a huge issue.
I think I wrote down fear. When you said fear, I wrote down fantasized experiences appearing real, F-E-A-R. Because I think anytime you're dealing with it, it's so hard because you project how the person's going to react. You project the fact that their husband's in real estate or real estate's tough right now. You project the fact that they're a single mother, but they're close to retirement, but there's no other jobs out there, but we'll be short staffed, but they're going to run to HR, they're going to run to the union, which I find both get bad deals because they don't protect the low performer, but we sort of use that as a rationalization. And I think we fantasize it in such a painful way that why would we go through with it? Because I think in healthcare, our DNA, this is I think it is an issue everywhere, Bob. When I did my Microsoft tour for Microsoft a couple of years ago, I remember talking to non-healthcare people and them coming up to me and saying, it's a big issue in non-healthcare too. Well, of course, the difference in our business is we can have people die from us not dealing with it. And I think it's that the only way I've helped people get through that is if they see by being fair to the problem, they're not being fair to the people that aren't creating the problem. But I think there is a fear, Bob. Tell us some of the other things that you've learned in dealing with when you talk to organizations. How do you get them over that fear? What type of training are we talking about here?
Sure. I was going to tell you one other thing before I tell you that maybe a solution. Quint, the first time I had to fire somebody, I remember she came in my office, and I got up from my desk. I said, excuse me a minute. I went in the bathroom next door and threw up
mm-hmm.
before I even did it. And so when I talk about this fear, I'm remembering my own experience.
No, you're right. I remember in Chicago, we had our chief financial officer was going to let somebody go, and he told everyone when he was going to do it, and every day he looked worse and worse and worse. I literally thought he might not make it to that meeting because he was internalizing it. It is very painful. It's very painful because no one wants to make that decision, has that negative impact on somebody's life. So I don't think you're underestimating the difficulty of this at all, Bob.
So to some solutions, some things that I see the places, the organizations that manage this issue of dealing with their low performers, helping them get better or move on, usually have very good standards of performance that are clearly written, very behavioral, and that literally starts the knowledge and the understanding of those standards and how important they are. Starts before they even get a blank application, all the way through orientation, and it's the way the organization lives. I know you've said that if organizations would just do what it says in their standards of performance, we wouldn't have optional behavior, we wouldn't have low performers, we wouldn't have inconsistency, we'd be getting better results. So number one, I think, on the list is, and this isn't every leader creating new standards, it's using the standards that are probably already written, that I see sometimes are excellently documented, but maybe not living it every day. That's number one. I think number two would be training specifically on how to differentiate your high performers, your middle performers, and your low performers so that we know who they are. Our high performers, as you know, we want to re-recruit them and keep them. Our middle performers, we want to re-recruit them, but we want to coach them to be a little better. And then if we put someone in this low-performing category, we've decided that the responsibility now shifts to them. We've done all the things that we can do. We've mentored them and coached them and loved on them and written them nice notes and gotten them extra help. And at some point, it becomes their responsibility. And then, as our training does, and as we teach this all over the world, is use the desk method to communicate. Describe the issue.
Hey, Bob. Bob, you know what?
Behavior.
Bob, if you don't mind, I'm sorry to interrupt. If you don't mind, why don't you hold that? We're going to have to go to a commercial break here in the next 20 seconds, and I think it's just too important. And we come back. We're going to come back with Bob Murphy, and he's going to talk about when you deal with performance issues. But, Bob, in closing, you said something that I've never heard but I'm going to remember, is number one, I think with high and middle performers, the responsibility goes to the leader to, one, recognize, recruit, and develop. But I love with the fact that the person with performance issues, the responsibility now goes to them because they really need to make the decision. Are they going to do what it takes to be successful, or are they going to hit the consequences of not being successful? So we're going to take a short break, but stay tuned. We'll be right back with Bob Murphy and more on how to be a better leader in healthcare right after this. Welcome back to the show with Talk Zone Radio. I'm your host, Quint Studer, and our guest today is Bob Murphy. Bob, you know, we're going to talk all about your nursing background and your experiences, but I'll tell you, if you don't mind, I'd like to keep right on going with this content, which is that whole fear. You know, I think when we hire, fear of dealing with a low performer and firing someone, of course, we all hope that the person performs well. We all hope that they can be redeemed. We all hope that they change, but the reality is it's very, very difficult to do that. You were going over a technique called DESC right before break, and I thought as now that we catch back up, and I sort of broke you off to go to the commercial break, but it's too important for me to not give you the time to do this. So if you could, for our individuals out there, why don't you go through a technique? And before you do that, I do want to bring up that's why training is so important. Because I've also found, Bob, that a leader sometimes uses an excuse is, well, I hold my people more accountable than others. So if I fire this one, they wouldn't be fired if they're over here. I had a radiology manager one time say to me, well, if I fire my people, then I'm going to be called the wicked leader because I hold people more accountable. And so we all have these rationalizations. Why don't you go over DESC for the listeners, Bob?
Sure. And as we begin, as we went to the last break, we were talking about the responsibility for the person who potentially is the low performer, what their responsibility is. And the theme that I use is that if I'm working harder for their success than they are, that they probably fit in this category of being a low performer. And so the DESC method is, I like it because it's so simple. It's easy to remember, but it includes all the important parts that we need to do for dealing with our low performers. Okay, so the D is to describe the behavior. Describe the behavior that you see that is wrong. It's the violation of the standards or the violation of the policy. Hopefully it's if one of those two things. And what I teach people to do is to make sure that we're describing behavior, not attitudes, meaning like my attitude towards it. Like, I won't use the words about disrespectful. I won't use words like insubordinate. But I will describe when you roll your eyes, when you say that's not my job, when you tell your fellow coworkers, when you bring up negative things or gossip about others. Very, very, very behavioral under the D for describing what they're doing wrong. The E is to evaluate. Evaluate what's happening, the process, the procedures, the step that's not followed. And very importantly, let them know the impact it has. Tell them the why. So when you roll your eyes and other staff members see that, they see that they might get the impression that you don't respect your leader. If you don't respect your leader, maybe they don't have to. When you say, it's not my job, what you're doing is telling other people that they're not important and you can dump on them. When you come late, what you're doing is making it so that your fellow coworkers might not get home in time to see their family, or they might get stuck. I remember when I was flying on the helicopter, if my relief came in late, I might get stuck on a two-hour flight and not make it to a family thing, or might not get my sleep time that I'm supposed to. Tell them the why as well and the impact it has on others. The S in DESC is to tell them what you want them to do. Show them exactly what you expect. And so show is sometimes literal, meaning if my work area is supposed to look a certain way at the end of my shift, literally show them how it works. Now, why is this part important? Because some people say one of two things. Nobody ever told me that before. Or they say something like, I didn't know that. I've never had that explained to me. So now it's crystal clear. Here's the behavior we see. Here's the impact it has. And here's how to do it better. And then the K is to know the consequence. Let them know what's going to happen if they don't change their behavior. And I think this is where leaders struggle. If I watch people do this and I have them role play it, this is where they struggle. Because knowing the consequence means I'm going to tell you what's going to happen next. And what might happen next might be a written warning, a 90-day probation, a final warning, or even termination. And I believe it's critically important to tell them that so that they can never say, I didn't know it was that serious, when you do have to move it to the next level. Plus, some people, and I know I did earlier in my career when I first became a nurse, I had a conversation like this with my boss, and she said, if you don't change this behavior, I'm going to fire you. And hearing the words, going to fire you, woke me up. Now, the neat part of that story is I left that job under my own power about a year later. I did well. I changed my behavior, went to fly on that helicopter, and became administrator of that hospital. If that boss didn't use the words, I'm going to fire you, I might not have changed my behavior. I might not be on this phone call today.
Bob, this is so relevant. I was talking over the weekend with Mort O'Sullivan. Mort owns a part owner of a large accounting firm here, and we were talking about the fact that he said to me that when they let somebody go, if that person is surprised, didn't expect it, didn't know it was this bad, that they see that as a failure on their part, a failure in leadership. And I will tell you that I think we get the DESC pretty good. We get the E pretty well. We get the S pretty well. I think if there's a weakness that I see in organizations, including Studer Group, it's that K. We tend to downplay the K. We tend to want to not be that direct. And I think in this situation, we have to be almost overly direct, overly specific, because people will say, gee, I knew I was having problems, but I didn't know it could lead to termination. I knew you were unhappy, but I didn't know it was this bad. At least, Bob, I don't know if that's your experience. I find out of the four, the K is the one that I think the people have the most specific challenge with.
I agree, because if you were looking at this method, it's got the most bad news in it. It's the part we like doing the least, mm-hmm. So we put it off. Or by the time we get there, by the time we've described the behavior and evaluated the impact and shown them, if they've done anything positive at all, if they've nodded or said, okay, I know, I get it, then we also start thinking, okay, well, maybe I got through to them and I don't have to give that final message, the really tough one that I don't want to give in the first place, because this is all it took. This is what they needed to get better, and that's usually not true.
But, Bob, that's, you know, we're going to have to get you back to do a whole nother show just on this issue, because there's so many tips that we, you know, and if you go to our website at www.studergroup.com, look up the words high, middle, low, HML, and they will really give you a number of specific viewpoints that Bob has gone over with them. Because, you know, even before we get into desk, Bob, there's, I believe, and you, I know you do too, it's the preparation, it's the role-playing, as you said, it's going to HR and being completely open with where you're at with documentation. It's going over it with your boss. When I was at Holy Cross Hospital in Chicago, we had a nurse leader named Sue who really, really was very good at structure. I mean, because she ran an inpatient rehab unit, which meant forget on the unit. A patient had to need so many hours of this, so many hours of this. And she was just great, and she a wonderful leader, and she was very, very good at holding people accountable. And I would actually have her buddy up with a leader, no matter who that leader was, before they're going to have this tough conversation. Because she would sort of help them prepare from her viewpoint, and she'd always say to them, now, after the conversation, I want you to meet with me right away. She'd time into doing it, and then she'd talk about that next step. So this is difficult for healthcare people. Our DNA is to not give up on people. Our DNA is to alleviate pain. Our DNA is to be a caretaker. So out of all that DNA that helps us in so many ways is the double-edged sword when it comes to deal with poor performers and poor performance. But if we don't, and we know in our studies of the wall, we'll hit that performance wall and never move past it. And Bob, I think it is a universal issue. Our research in my book, Straight A Leadership, shows the average manager has 1.78 people in their own department that are not meeting expectations, and only about 50% of them have any documentation. Bob, I want to hit your last universal truth, and we only have about 6.5 minutes left, so we're going to have to not go into detail, but Bob, of course, we hope you're a regular guest on this show. Talk about the first universal truth was inconsistency. The second universal truth was that fear-like problem of dealing with performance. And your third one you said was sequencing. For our listeners, can you go over a little bit on what you meant by that word, sequencing?
Sure. First of all, we just know from our research and our work that some tactics to get results are easier to do than others. To get sort of your approach and our approach at Studer Group to give you the least amount of work to get the most amount of results. We struggle sometimes. I see organizations struggling sometimes with two things related to sequencing. Either one is piling on too many things. I personally struggle with this one. I get excited. I'm teaching a senior leadership team, and I want to say, and here's the three things you should do. And really, what I should be saying is, here's the one thing you should be doing. And when you do that well, then go to the next one. Because research shows that the more stuff you try to pile on, the least effective you're going to be. That's the first part of sequencing, is piling on. The second part of sequencing that I see is literally organizations trying to take on difficult stuff before they got basic stuff. Mm-hmm. Let me be very specific. Our tactic of rounding for outcomes on staff is a foundational item. We teach it early on in our engagements. We know that when the better engaged my staff is and the better the leader-staff relationship is, the more likely I could do other things more effectively. But I go to places all the time that skip that and go right to hard things, like a great tactic, hourly rounding, rounding on patients. It's a wonderful tactic. The clinical results are literally worldwide now. But it's really hard to get all those people to change their behavior. And so there are some places sort of picking and choosing like an a la carte menu, and they pick the hard stuff first sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's one of the ones we see. Do not forget the fundamentals. Do not forget the basics.
I go to an organization, Bob, and they want to get, you know, better physician engagement. And they want to take a topic, an issue that's been they've been disagreeing with for 35 years with the doctors on, like pay for ER call or medical director salaries or employing or not employing physicians or managed care. I mean, things that have just been tense that they've never agreed upon. And that's the first thing they want to solve.
Right.
And I'll say, well, let's go back a little bit. Let's work on getting the chart. So when the doctor has a question, they have the chart. And I know for the listeners, they might say, well, that doesn't hit the real issue. Well, it starts to set the foundation up. And what I'm saying is we might not be able to fix certain issues, but let's fix those that we can fix and get them behind us so we sort of get the little bit of an emotional bank account. And I agree with you. People jumped into hourly rounding. And, you know, when I do speaking, I'll say to a nurse leader, for you to implement nurse leader rounding, how many people's behavior do you need to change? And, you know, sometimes it's her or him. Sometimes it's a couple charge nurses, an assistant manager. But, Bob, it's usually between one and four max. Then I'll say, in order to do hourly rounding, how many people need to change behavior? They'll say 74, 63. Right, so let's start with the one to four. So I think the sequencing is crucial. And I think sometimes we move to the second thing a little too soon. Bob, any other messages on sequencing?
No, that's the key part. It's understanding what will get you the most, understanding what will get you the most results most quickly with the least amount of work so you can get some wins under your belt, especially if you're trying new things and you're trying to, even if you're a new leader and you want to build credibility with your staff and your physicians and your boss, pick things that you know you can be successful at and build on those. If you're going to do rounding and you want to do nurse leader rounding, it's probably easier to do staff rounding first so you could build up the skills of rounding. I mean, it's like what we do with CPR, airway, then breathing, then circulation. Why? Because the studies show, research shows, that's what's the most effective. If I run right in and I start doing compressions, I probably won't have as good of an outcome. Same thing applies here. And the last thought is, this is also one of those really hard ones, Quint, just like dealing with low performers. I know how hard it is just to change my own behavior. I'm a guy trying to lose weight, and I try. I just don't get results. Why? Because it's hard just to get myself to change my behavior, let alone people around me.
Bob, we have 1 minute, and I know for those of you that are listening to the show, if you'd like to get Bob Murphy to come to your organization, if you go to www.studergroup.com, there's information on there under speakers. Also, you can call 850-934-1099 and ask for Sheila, and she will be happy to talk about how to get Bob Murphy to come out into your organization. Bob, we've got about 30 seconds. That's not a long time. Any message for our listeners today?
Just keep learning. I guess if I were going to get one universal message from me, there are great tactics to address everything that we've brought up here today. Remember that you probably don't know what you don't know, so asking your boss if they can help you, asking people you trust in your organization if they could recommend skills for you. We have a lot available, as Quint's mentioned, on our website. But if you don't know what you don't know, you won't change anything.
And sometimes you need that outside opinion. Bob, thank you so much for being our guest today and what you do in healthcare. We're going to close today with the song called The Calling. It's by Al Call and Lisa Carey, and it's about how people that go into healthcare have a calling. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we hope you join us in our next Talk Zone show. This is Quint Studer. Thank you for making a difference.
distant whisper. The message was unclear, but as time went by, it got so it was all that I could hear. The calling was calling me, and I could hear it. The calling was calling me. Whoa, 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 the calling.
Hear the calling.
Whoa, 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 the calling.
I began to see little miracles, connections of the heart. I began to see how fires can grow from a single passionate spark.
The calling was calling me,
and I could hear it.
The calling was calling me
in my soul.
The calling was calling me,
I could hear it.
The calling was calling me.
Following my inner voice, I have no regrets at all. I just thank God I was listening when I got the call. I'm not sure when it sparked the fire deep inside that made me wanna make a difference, to touch others'